Well, good afternoon. Thank you to the organisers for inviting me to talk to you today. I'm going to whiz through some slides. Asked for a title. I'd just been talking to a colleague about Alka-Seltzer tablets in relation to ocean acidification. So this one got down to talking about size. So the 4 billion ton Alka-Seltzer tablet versus a 1 pound lobster, which is subsized and wouldn't normally get fished. So we'll talk about some of these things. Clearly you can't discuss ocean acidification without having a sense of what ocean acidification is. So what are we talking about? Well, a decrease in the pH of the ocean due to the uptake of anthropogenic carbon dioxide. So that's CO2 that we're producing getting absorbed into the oceans. And there's been a 30 to 40% of the CO2 released by human activity gets in the atmosphere, dissolves into the oceans, into rivers, and into lakes. And what happens is this reacts with the water to form carbonic acid, and part of this carbonic acid then dissociates, and that gives the hydrogen ion. And that's the thing that's driving the fall in the pH within the oceans. And so, to give it some kind of scale, between 1751 1994, ocean pH fell from 8.24 to 8.15. Now, that doesn't sound by much, but you need to remember that pH scales are logarithmic. So this is effectively a 30% increase in the hydrogen ions in the oceans. So the numbers for the pH ranges sound small, but actually their impact is significant. Another facet of this that's important for this talk is the fact that this pH change reduces the availability of calcium carbonate. And you'll see as we go through the talk that this is really important for those animals that produce shells. I mean, we're talking shellfish, but predominantly things like mollusks that are produced for commercial purposes like oysters and clams and mussels. So as I say, we had a conversation. Somebody said you'd need a pretty big Alka-Seltzer tablet to deal with ocean acidification. So I kind of raised the question, does anybody know how big that tablet would need to be? And we kind of batted this one around, and somebody came back and said to me, 4 billion tons. I went, that's pretty big. And then he goes, well, you want another line. If you scraped all the limestone that's available on the surface of the earth into the oceans, you would just about put us back to where we should be currently. But that's only resetting the clock for ocean acidification. The level of change is substantial, and we have to kind of put it in context. So the flip side of this is the lobster industry. So I work in Maine, and it's frightening actually how big this industry is in Maine. So in 2010, 85% of lobsters landed in New England were landed in Maine. It is one of our main, excuse the pun, our big industries. Maine landed £103 million, valued at $335 million. And 90% of those were caught within state waters, so within 3 miles of the coast. And a conservative estimate within the state that the lobster industry is worth about $1 billion to the state of Maine. So any kind of failure in that industry will have severe repercussions. And somebody's coined it that it's a bit of a gilded trap, that we're catching more lobsters than we've ever caught before. But actually, the last few years, the market price has been really kind of depressed. So the value is going down. So we're catching more, the value is less, but people are becoming more and more reliant on this one species in the state of Maine. And so anything that impacts this animal and makes it less valuable is going to have serious repercussions across the eastern seaboard of the US, but very, very specifically in the state of Maine. So I put this in just so that you can start to understand some of the problems when I go through some of the data that we've been generating. So this is a lobster life cycle. You thought I was standing up with these. We got pointers. So so we go in the cycle, we come out from embryo to newly hatched larvae. This can take 9 to 12 months after the eggs have been released by the female. She holds on to them for about a year. But the bit that I'm interested in is this: once the larvae, the eggs hatch, we get larval development through stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. And by stage 4, you can see that the animal effectively looks like an adult lobster. Only it's only a few millimetres long. And at this point, what happens is, up until this point, the animals float in the surface of the sea, in the pelagic layer. And at this point, they sink and become benthic. And there's a lot of physiological changes associated with these kind of morphologies as the animal grows and moves through the larval and post-larval stages. So this is one of our little babies. This is a stage 1 larvae. And you can see that he's kind of transparent. And he floats around in the surface. He doesn't have much calcium carbonate. His shell isn't very hard. His shell is quite flexible. And he breathes through it. At this point, when they're floating in the surface, he exchanges oxygen and carbon dioxide through his shell, not using the gills that it will have later. And they swim. They don't walk. So they have appendages attached to the sides of the legs when they're larvae that help them swim in the water. But once they get through, you'll see, they change from swimming to walking. So it's important to see that they're living in a different environment from the adults. This is a larvae later on. You can see it's much more opaque. The shell's starting to darken. And at this point, they go from stage 3 to stage 4. This is a late stage 3, so it doesn't have the big claws that you would associate with the adult. But what happens here is the animal moves from swimming to a walking form. You get a lot more kind of calcification of the carapace, and with that, the animal changes its gas exchange, and it can no longer diffuse because it's hardening its shell. It can't diffuse gas through its shell, and it moves onto the gills for respiration gas exchange. I had a graduate student looking at development of lobster larvae in varying pH situations, and we got pipped to the post in publication. So this is actually the paper that's out in the press, and this is Elise Keppel working up in New Brunswick, and effectively they found the same thing. So I'm not going to rain on her parade. She managed to get out there before we did. But what they found, and what we found, is that if you grow lobsters in the current pH of 8.1, 8.15, and you take a cautious estimate of what the pH for the oceans is going to be in, say, 50 years, 30 years, and you drop it down to a pH of 7.9, then that small pH change is having a substantial impact on the development of these larvae, such that pale bars are the acidified environment, the darker bars is the control environment, and what you start to see is this is carapace length over the stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so the carapace, the animals are not as big over the same time frame. So when they're in the same larval stage, growing in a pH-reduced environment, they are not as big. And the other thing that's happening, and this bottom chart shows you the time to molt. it's taking them longer to get to the molt point. And it's something I want to try and kind of stress to you. These two issues have lots of consequences. One of the things that we found was we started to notice intermediate stages. Now, intermediates have been known for a long time, over 100 years, first found in 1905. But they're usually associated with things like low temperature, low salinity. If you take the eye stalks out, if you like butchering lobster larvae, you can induce these intermediate stages. And what happens is the animal inserts partial developmental stages, usually between stage 3 and stage 4. And you have to understand that the animal can only grow by molting. And so to get these developmental changes, it has to molt. But if the environment isn't right, then what it tries to do is get bigger without inducing all the physiological changes that are normally associated with a shift from, say, stage 3 to stage 4. So it puts a partial stage, developmental stage, in the middle. So what you can see, if this is a normal stage 4, and you can see that here are the swimming appendages that are normally associated with a stage 3 up here. And normally they get lost as the animal moves from a swimming environment to a walking environment. But these appendages remain in these intermediate stages. And there are other morphological identifiers that say that this is not an animal that's gone fully to stage 4. Other issues that have been seen that we noticed, too, was a team in Bergen studying European lobster did the same trick, and they noticed a lot of carapace lifting and curling, and you can see what's happening here. The carapace, the main kind of body shell, is lifting away from the larvae. And we thought it was an artifact, but with discussing with them, they thought originally it was an artifact. Just, you know, a quirk of collecting the samples and putting them in preservative and stuff. But then they noticed they only occurred in the low pH. So as I say, lobsters are arthropods. They can only grow by molting. So that, you know, we have an internal skeleton, they have an external skeleton. They have to shed that skeleton in order to grow bigger. And in the developmental cycle for lobsters, they prepare for a benthic lifestyle at each of these points through their larval stages. And one of the issues that they have is that if they stay in the pelagic layer, they spend more time at risk of predation. So there's a lot of attrition that goes on in that layer. A lot of larvae get eaten. And if they have to spend more time there because they cannot evolve, cannot develop fast enough, they're open to predation. Another species of interest, especially in Maine, oysters, a lot of oyster farming, a lot of oyster hatcheries. And people have been looking at impact of ocean acidification on oysters. This is a sequence of photographs. So up here we've got pre-industrial levels of CO2 at 280 ppm, present at 350 ppm, the kind of middle forecasts for near future at 750 ppm, and the extreme levels that people are forecasting for, say, 100 years' time, 150 years' time, at 1500 ppm. And you can see the reduction in the size of the animals and the reduction in the kind of density of shell these animals are able to produce. And this kind of spun out from hatcheries on the west coast in Washington. In 2005, they noticed that they weren't getting any production out of the hatcheries because they were getting acidified water being pumped into the hatcheries from the sea. So they've had real issues with this. They've been looking at how to kind of ameliorate the water coming into the hatcheries to make sure it isn't too acidic so they can actually produce larvae. Another one from Mark Green at St. Joseph's College in Maine, looking at clams. And again, from the left to the right, you can look at animals placed in acidified water. And this is pretty acidic. This is 7.5. But as they move from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, it only takes 72 hours for some substantial kind of dissolution of the shell. And they've looked at other issues in this. And as the pH falls, the animal, not only can it not create enough shell, but it can't create it fast enough to stop it dissolving. And so when we look at this, shellfish use two forms of calcium carbonate to form shell, calcite and aragonite. Most of it is aragonite. And one of the problems with this is that aragonite is much more soluble than the calcite. And so it's the first kind of layer to dissolve when things get tough. And the calcification is, you know, the precipitation of dissolved ions within the seawater to create solid structures. And we have this issue that you need to build those structures fast enough to stop them from dissolving. And so there's this issue that can you pull the material out of the water at such a rate that you can compensate for the loss of a low pH environment. I was asked to think about kind of prevention and treatments for this. Clearly the obvious one is to reduce our carbon footprint, stop producing so much CO2, pumping out CO2 into the atmosphere. We could try the giant Alka-Seltzer. It's a bit of a... It's not a good idea, I don't think. Interestingly, Mark Green looked at adding crushed shell back into the clam mudflats. And I've cited his paper up here. And he found that work really, really well. If you're kind of seeding waste shell material back into the mudflats that you're growing clams on, you get a very, very good kind of regeneration of your clam beds. But it's almost a band-aid technology. It isn't going to get you round the problem that the pH in the oceans is forming. Another one is one of our claims to fame in Maine is we have one of the only kelp farms in the US. And this is Tolliff Hansen. He runs a farm called Ocean Approved in Casco Bay near Portland. And they produce seaweed. And one of the issues is seaweed seems to act as a refuge. So you get a rise in the pH around seaweed. So it looks like, and people aren't quite sure why, but it looks like seaweed is helping to kind of ameliorate the drop in the ocean pH. So maybe what we should do is start increasing seaweed farming. It's very good, I have to say. Not that they're paying me, but you know, we're looking to increase the amount of kelp that's being farmed in the environment. And as a consequence of doing that, we may have a way of reducing the impact of pH in local areas. Finally, the 1-pound lobster. Well, as I say, it's too small to actually take in a wild catch. But some companies, and particularly Red Lobster, were interested in being able to sell small lobsters that you can't actually generate from a wild harvest. But if we could culture them in aquaculture, which is pretty close to being able to do that, then maybe you can actually grow these animals to a small size and have a kind of specialized market that would relieve the pressure on wild populations. And maybe we can get through the kind of financial issues looking at alternative ideas. Okay, thank you.